The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to another episode of American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, and lore of America's past. The show is hosted by Cody Beck and Troy Taylor, and today we are continuing our third season, which we call Murdered in Their Beds. If you're tuning into the podcast for the first time, we recommend going back to episode 36 and start the new season from there. It's the first part in the series and marks the beginning of the transient butcher's reign of terror in the Midwest of the early 1900s. Each episode will not only explore the killer's horrific crimes, but will explore the effect he had on the small railroad towns of the region, especially the town of Villisca, Iowa. So turn up the lights, lock all the doors, and prepare yourself for the next installment of Murdered in Their Beds. In southwestern Iowa, they called it the Summer of Fear. The entire region was on edge. Years later, folks would talk about the horrific things that happened that summer, from the murders to the terrible storms that wreaked havoc on the landscape. Damaging winds and violent electrical storms pounded the area, and at least a half dozen farm buildings near Villisca, including two houses and several barns, were destroyed by wind or burned after being hit by lightning. Several unlucky farmers lost their entire crop of oats, and a new house built by John Slack burned to the ground. But the weather, of course, was not the most prominent topic of conversation that summer. Everyone was still talking about the murders. Fear still loomed over the small town. Doors were still being locked at night. And after dark, the streets of Villisca were nearly deserted. The Stillingers had more sorrow that summer. A few days after Ida and Lena's funerals, Sarah Stillinger lost her unborn son. And before the year was over, their family home was destroyed by fire. Iowa Governor Burl F. Carroll announced in June that the state was offering a $500 reward for information leading to an arrest in the Villisca case. But those in southwest Iowa saw this as a hollow gesture. It was a paltry sum, they said. While $500 was a lot of money in 1912, it seemed an inadequate reward for finding the killer of eight people. Angry Villisca residents vowed to raise more money, and they did. The reward fund, which grew into thousands of dollars thanks to donations from locals and from people across the country, was deposited in the First National Bank in Villisca, which was owned by Frank Jones. Governor Carroll defended the reward, pointing out correctly that he was limited to $500 per case by statute and couldn't legally offer more. But what most people didn't know then was that the state was doing a lot more behind the scenes. Carroll had given approval to Attorney General George Cozen to hire a detective from the famed Burns Detective Agency. The agency, which had branch offices all over the country and overseas, had been founded by William J. Burns, who had quite a reputation as a crime solver in those days. He would soon earn the moniker of America's Sherlock Holmes after clearing Leo Frank of the sensational murder of Mary Fagan in 1915. Burns had been born in Baltimore, Maryland, and was educated in Ohio. As a young man, he'd been a Secret Service agent and used his reputation to form his own detective agency. A combination of natural ability as an investigator combined with an instinct for publicity made Burns a national figure. His exploits made national news, the gossip columns of New York newspapers and the pages of detective magazines, in which he published true crime stories based on his exploits. Iowa state officials believed that the investigation was in good hands with the Burns agency involved. It would only be a matter of time, they believed, before the case would be solved. A detective from the Burns office in Kansas City named C.W. Toby was assigned to the case. Toby insisted that he wanted to work undercover for a time, and so he came to Villisca in secret. He wanted to investigate the scene, talk to people, and see what he could learn from local gossip and speculation. He was already in town when locals began complaining about the Iowa governor's reward fund, but because Toby was then working in secret, Carroll could not admit that a detective had already been hired. Toby identified himself only to State's Attorney Ratcliffe, Sheriff Jackson, Constable Hank Horton, and a handful of officials that he thought needed to know of his presence in town. There is no indication that Toby or O'Leary, the detective brought in by Hank Horton, had any problems with one another, even though they were in direct competition. In fact, there's no record of them having any contact at all. Both men hoped to track down the killer, claim the growing reward, and make front page news as the detective who caught the Villisca murderer. Neither shared information with the other, and they had no contact with any of the other professional and amateur detectives who were roaming the countryside. Toby, like all other Burns detectives, traveled with a typewriter that he used to file daily reports that were mailed to both the Kansas City and Chicago offices. Another copy was sent directly to Governor Carroll. Toby felt that he had a huge break in the case only days after his arrival in town, but what happened illustrates the problems that occurred with having a dozen or more investigations going on at the same time. Mike Kearns was one of two night watchmen who worked in Villisca. The other watchman, Henry Mike Overman, had seen someone he didn't recognize in the town square on the night of the murder and let the man pass without checking to see who he was. He was later criticized for letting this happen, and so Kearns undoubtedly had instructions to check out any stranger that he encountered. On the night of July 6th, he approached a poorly dressed man at the railroad depot and began to question him. The man began acting strangely and then suddenly fled into the darkness. Kearns, along with Hank Horton, searched for the man all night, but they never found him. However, they did discover that he had checked his baggage at the station. He had given the name Otto Matusbak, and his suitcases were checked through to Chicago. Horton contacted Sheriff Jackson and Agent O'Leary, who was working for the county. Even though Toby was in town and had made himself known to law enforcement officials, they didn't bother to tell him about the incident. And why would they? It was a strange man at the train station on July 6th, almost a month after the murders. But anyway, Sheriff Jackson contacted authorities in Chicago and asked them to apprehend whoever came to the express window to collect the man's baggage. 3 days later, on July 9th, Chicago police officers picked up the man, and it was only then that Toby was told about the suspect. The only reason he heard about it at all was because he was with Horton when the telegram from Chicago arrived. Toby was irritated by the local police officer's failure to communicate with him, but he made the best of the situation. In his report that night, he noted that he had spoken with Jackson and Ratcliffe about the situation and had confirmed with the Chicago police that Jackson would be leaving in the morning to pick up the prisoner. The next morning, knowing that a letter would reach Governor Carroll faster than his report, and probably worried that none of his recent reports had mentioned a man that locals considered a prime suspect, he quickly sent a letter to the governor, and he began it with, quote, "We have under arrest," unquote, and went on to explain that Matusbak fit the description of one of the men seen in town on the weekend of the murders. Not really. He asked the governor to keep everything under the strictest confidence and added that he was hopeful that this arrest may straighten out affairs here. But as it turned out, Matusbak had nothing to do with the murders. He had been working in Missouri for the previous 3 months. He had been 200 miles away at the time of the murder and had left on July 6th to return to Chicago. He had stopped in Villisca only to change trains. No one knows why he ran from Kearns that night, but after he had established his alibi, he was released from custody. Toby had to follow up his letter about the arrest with one that exonerated the only suspect he had. But he went back to work and continued his investigation during July and August, only leaving in September after he was promoted to the position of manager at the Burns office in Chicago. He ran down dozens of leads and investigated a number of remote possibilities, but in the end, he turned up nothing of value. He'd heard the rumors about Frank Jones's involvement in the case, but dismissed them. He also heard about Reverend Kelly doing some strange things, but he had little interest in the odd little man as a suspect. It seemed obvious to Toby that the killer was no longer in Villisca. He eventually left town disappointed that none of his leads panned out. In July, Reverend Kelly was back in town. He was now referring to himself as a detective, claiming that he had trained as a criminologist while living in London. His theories about the crime varied from time to time, but in some letters, he stated that he believed the killer was a member of the Moore family. He never named a suspect, but in letters written in the weeks after the murders, his ideas seemed to coincide with the early speculations about Sam Moyer, the itinerant drifter who had been married to JB's younger sister, Anna. Regardless of what he wrote, though, Kelly would talk to anyone who would listen to him about the murders. One night, he became so agitated in the lobby of the Villisca Hotel that frightened guests asked Mike Kearns to come over and settle him down. Kelly was ranting about the murder in which he believed the killings had occurred, performing a vigorous reenactment of the attacks. Detectives Toby and O'Leary dealt with Reverend Kelly in different ways. Kelly wrote to and spoke with both men and offered to work with them. He insisted on telling them about the ideas that he received from visions and dreams. Toby wanted nothing to do with the obvious oddball and eventually wrote him a very sternly worded letter that made that clear. O'Leary, on the other hand, cultivated the relationship. He apparently felt that Kelly had something worthwhile to offer. Toby remained in Villisca until his move to Chicago. At that point, a Burns detective named W.S. Gordon took his place in town. Gordon called the case, quote, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, crime mysteries in the history of the United States, unquote. He said that the Burns agency had never faced a bigger challenge. He spent the fall of 1912 helping the police to eliminate suspects in the case. That period marked the high point of the relationship between the Burns Agency and the state of Iowa. It would continue until 1915, but it became increasingly volatile over time, especially after an incident in the fall of 1912. Most of the people in Villisca spent the summer of 1912 going about their usual routines during the daytime. But at night, it was a different story. The initial terror had passed, but it was still common to find two or three families sleeping in one house. Many farmers took their wives and children to the home of a friend or a relative after evening chores. Sheriff Jackson probably hurt the situation more than helped it that summer, making frightening newspaper statements like, quote, this is the most terrible and deadly menace with which society has ever had to deal. Heaven only knows where these fanatics may strike next. It may be my family, it may be yours. He also told the press that, quote, when the next family is found murdered by an axe and that discovery of this kind will be shortly made, I'm certain the police in the entire country should cooperate in running down the perpetrator, unquote. It took only a matter of weeks for his prediction to come true. Another axe murder occurred in Illinois in September, and even though it would turn out to have no connection to Villisca, it sent shockwaves through the investigation and nearly ruined the relationship between the Burns Detective Agency and the state of Iowa. In the early morning hours of Sunday, September 29th, 1912, brutal murders were committed in a lonely house near Payson, Illinois, a quiet farm community east of Quincy. The murders would stun the people of Western Illinois, ruin the lives of the accused killer and his fiancée, and shock the Midwest. On the morning of September 30th, news reporters in Quincy were already at work fanning the flames of panic. Murdered in home, screamed the headlines, spreading the news of the previous day's events. The newspaper columns that followed told the harrowing tale of the murders of Charles Fanschmidt, his wife Matilda, their 15-year-old daughter Blanche, and a young schoolteacher, Emma Campen, who boarded with the family. The bodies were removed from the Fanschmidt home after a fire swept through the residence on Sunday. The police surmised that they might have been killed as early as Friday night, and the fire set the next day to destroy the evidence. Telephone lines to the house had been cut, making it impossible for friends to reach them on Saturday. Neighbors spotted smoke coming from the house very early on Sunday morning and alerted the authorities. By the time they arrived, it was burning out of control. The fire nearly destroyed the house, and when the metal roof was removed, the bodies of three women were found lying on blood-soaked mattresses in what would have been the upstairs bedrooms of the house. The roof had preserved the corpses well enough to reveal that the women had been bludgeoned with an axe while they were sleeping. Another body was discovered in the ruins of the cellar. There was so little remaining of the charred corpse that it was impossible to determine its sex. The flesh and bones of the head, arms, shoulders, upper trunk, legs, and half of the lower trunk were gone. Only one thigh remained. A doctor later testified that the body had been dismembered with knives and a saw before it was burned. It was eventually determined that the body belonged to Charles Fanschmidt. Near the body in the cellar was an axe head with what was later determined was human blood baked on it from the intense heat of the flames. The handle of the axe had been completely burned away. Police officers and sheriff's deputies immediately descended on the scene, gathering law enforcement personnel and armed citizens to search the countryside for the killer. Bloodhounds were brought to the scene in an effort to trace the murderer who, it was believed, had driven to the home in a buggy on Saturday night, a few hours before the fire was discovered. It was no surprise that the police believed that Billy the Axeman had struck again. According to newspaper reports, they were seeking, quote, the degenerate who had perpetrated several axe murders in Iowa and Colorado recently, unquote. They also noted that the crime was similar to the horror in Villisca, and the local police were not the only ones who believed this. This new murder got the attention of the Iowa Attorney General, and he asked the Burns Detective Agency to send a man to look into it. C.W. Toby, who had worked the Villisca case in July and August before going off to manage the agency's Chicago office, assigned himself to the investigation. Detective Thomas O'Leary from the Kirk's Detective Agency was still embroiled in the Villisca case, and he also went to Quincy to investigate. The two men were soon to clash, causing a situation that managed to help the killer escape prosecution. Before either detective arrived in Quincy, the Adams County Sheriff had arrested Ray Fanschmidt, age 20, the only surviving offspring of the murdered couple. The young man had moved out of his family's home in August to start work on an excavation project for the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad. He was living in a tent near the work site. The main evidence against him was a set of buggy tracks that led away from the Fanschmidt house, which may or may not have matched his buggy, and suspicious bloodstained clothing that may or may not have belonged to him. The clothes had been discovered by accident. J.L. Fries, who lived near the work camp, was making improvements on his property and moved an outhouse to a new location. When the structure was moved, he found a bundle of bloody clothing hidden beneath it and called the police. The khaki shirt and pants were spattered with blood, which could have been either human or animal because Adams County Sheriff had no way to test it, with the largest stains measuring about 2 inches in diameter. When the police showed the clothing to Ray's fiance, Esther Reeder, she said that they might belong to him. This was not exactly hard evidence, but in those days, the police could arrest just about anyone, whether the evidence against them was solid or not. Soon, other information emerged, however. On the surface, none of it looked good for Ray. His father, Charles, had owned a considerable amount of real estate, and his wife had owned large tracts of land that she had inherited from her father. Upon the deaths of the older couple, their land and money would go to their children, meaning that Ray stood to gain a large inheritance after the murders. It was known that he had money problems. In the weeks prior to the murders, Charles received two notes from his bank informing him that his son's accounts were overdrawn. Charles had allegedly complained to a friend about Ray's spending habits, and that was all the motive that prosecutors needed to pin the crime on Ray. Detective Thomas O'Leary, who was still working for Montgomery County, Iowa, arrived in Quincy to look into the case. He quickly decided that the evidence was overwhelming. Ray Fanschmidt was the killer, and the murders had nothing to do with Villisca. Detective Toby, though, saw things differently. While his bill was being paid by the state of Iowa to determine if the crimes of Villisca and Payson were related, he talked to a few people and visited Ray Fanschmidt in jail. After meeting with the Burns detective, Fanschmidt hired Toby as an expert witness to testify that the murders could have been committed by the roving axe maniac who had slaughtered people in Colorado, Kansas, Illinois, and Iowa. Toby, considered an expert in the other cases, was supposed to provide an element of reasonable doubt for the defense. In the end, it worked, but things started off badly for Ray. At the initial trial in March 1913, Ray was tried and convicted for the murder of his sister. It was common practice in multiple murder cases to charge the defendant with only one death. That way, if he was exonerated, he could be tried again for another, allowing the prosecutor to skirt past the double jeopardy rule. Ray was found guilty and headed for the gallows in October. The evidence against him was circumstantial, but Ray was perceived as being greedy and spoiled. It didn't help his prospects when his grandfather testified in court about his constant demands for money. Quote, I told him, Ray, you're going to the dogs and you're going there damn fast, the old man was quoted as saying, no doubt with grim satisfaction. His lawyers appealed the case, stating that a change of venue request should have been granted due to the extreme prejudice against the defendant expressed by people living in the area. They argued that some of the evidence, including letters from the bank regarding overdrafts, should not have been admitted. In February 1914, Ray was granted a new trial by the Illinois Supreme Court. He was retried for the murder of his sister and found not guilty. Well, he was then put on trial for the murder of his father, and reasonable doubt won over again. The case for the murder of his mother was dismissed, and the authorities didn't try to convict him again. Ray collected his inheritance and left Adams County for good. Many people strongly believe that Ray had gotten away with murder. If so, C.W. Toby helped him. For a time, the Burns detective was on the payroll of not only the state of Iowa, but was also being paid by the man he was been hired to investigate. It may have seemed like an ethical dilemma, but if Toby could have connected the case in Illinois to the case in Iowa, he would have done so. The reward fund connected to the Villisca murders alone was substantial, and Toby, along with the Burns agency, would have profited from a solution to the crime. Things were eventually smoothed over, and the agency would continue to work for the state until 1915, although no hard evidence was ever obtained by the Burns detectives. The Illinois murder stunned the people of Villisca. They had pinned all their hopes on a solution to their own murders, but that was not to be. There was no connection between the two crimes, other than that the murders were committed with an axe. The Fanschmidt crime, while baffling, had almost none of the similarities between the earlier murders in Colorado, Kansas, Iowa, and elsewhere in Illinois. I take that back. There was one other connection between the Fanschmidt murders and all the others. The murder in Payson would also never be solved. The murders in Payson, Illinois that year show how quick that everyone involved in the Villisca murders, including law enforcement officials, wanted to believe that a sinister, faceless killer was at work. They didn't want to believe that the man who had murdered the Moore family and the Stillinger girls could be a local, someone that they all knew. Billy the Axeman had now taken on the role of a Midwest boogeyman, lurking behind every murder where an axe was used and in some where it wasn't. Near Council Bluffs, Iowa in the summer of 1912, a Danish farmer named Martin Thompson, his wife and their 8-year-old son were found dead in their home. Their throats had been cut with a butcher's knife, and the heads of the woman and boy had been smashed with a hammer. Early reports incorrectly stated that all of them had been killed by an axe. Newspapers and local gossip immediately speculated about a connection to Villisca, Colorado, Kansas, and Illinois murders, and Sheriff Jackson and County Attorney Ratcliffe went there to pursue it. When they arrived, their hopes were dashed when local authorities showed them a suicide note written by Thompson. He'd killed his wife and son and then turned the knife to his own throat. After their hopes had been dashed by the evidence in the Fanschmidt murders in Illinois, the authorities began another anxious frenzy of searching for clues in Villisca. Things had become so desperate they were willing to try anything, even spreading the word that Lena Stillinger could identify her killer. According to a newspaper report, detectives had somehow acquired a photograph of the murderer from an image preserved on the retina of one of Lena's eyes. She had apparently awakened during the attack, and her body was found with its eyes open. They were checking the image now, they said, and planned to make an announcement about the killer's identity soon. Needless to say, no announcement ever came. It's believed that the story was planted by one of the detectives in the case, hoping that it might force the murderer to identify himself in some way if he thought that his name was going to be revealed. Billy the Axeman continued to strike fear in the hearts of people all over the Midwest. But where was he? And would he strike again soon? If you have the nerve to return for our next episode, we'll be taking a journey to the town of Paola, Kansas, in early June 1912, the last Axeman attack before the killer arrived in Villisca. So remember to lock the doors when you go to bed tonight. And just in case, you might want to look under the bed and make sure no one is hiding there. You don't want to end up on the Axeman's list.
There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about, and that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book, and they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself, and I sent it to my mom, and she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do, so I'm really glad to have this. And I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother, too. So check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
All right.
Thanks for tuning into the American Hauntings Podcast, the show where we discuss history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. You've caught up with us in Season 3, which we call Murdered in Their Beds, the true story of the Midwest axe murders of the 1900s. I'm your co-host, Cody Beck, and with me is my co-host, author, historian, crime buff, and the founder of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor.
Hey, glad to be here again.
So, yeah, thanks for coming back.
I think actually every time I should say that we're glad to be here because it beats the alternative.
Right.
So
I should introduce you to Sam. I have a special guest this week, Troy Taylor.
Right. Yeah, happy to be here in the studio with you.
Thanks for making the time, man. You know, I know it's scheduling. It's my assistant talking to your assistant's assistant.
It's hard to, you know, get that all worked out.
Oh, man, it's tough. Okay, so we've been starting off each episode now acknowledging some of the iTunes reviews that we've been getting. And so I wanted to start off by sharing a review from Kimmy N. She said, I'm new to the podcast, but it's awesome. Very informative about the locations, which I truly love. And then the other creepy stuff mixed in. I love the banter. Well, thank you. I did want to ask Cody and Troy.
It was cringeworthy.
I know. I did want to ask Cody and Troy. Go back to American Hauntings Podcast 13. Start listening at 2140. There are several people in the room and I can hear talking. But who's whispering if you're all talking? So my first answer is ghosts. The second and most likely answer, it's probably actually my little brother, Ricky.
Oh, yeah. I forgot he was there.
Kind of producing that show for me because, long story short, I had something else I had to do. And we were getting all the guides together.
Yeah, you weren't there.
I wasn't there.
Point.
I was there
That's
for the
right.
first
you
one.
You had to leave. Yeah. I remember that now.
Yeah. So it was really, really hard to coordinate all the schedules of all the guides.
Right.
And the time that they could get together, I couldn't be there. So we had somebody else come in. And I'm guessing Ricky was probably like, am I doing this right? right? Or like, you know, what am I doing?
It probably was him. I didn't think about that.
So thanks for the review on iTunes. We really appreciate that. And the rating, and it really helps people find our podcast.
Right.
So thank you so much for that. We have some stuff coming up, some events and things.
We do. Actually, April 30th, which is by the time you hear this, will be just days away, I believe.
Yeah.
And I have a new book coming out called A Song of Dance and Death, which is, as I like to, just short descriptor, sex, drugs, magic, murder, rock and roll.
It's amazing.
If you were at the conference last year, at the Haunted America conference, I did a presentation on part of this book, on some of the curses in the 27 Club. And that's a small part of this book. It's all about the, you know, the effect of the occult and the history of rock and roll. It was a fun book to do.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's just one of those things. And I am not a musician. I've never been a musician. I cannot sing a lick. But I've been, you know, obsessed with music my whole life. So this was one of those books that I've always wanted to write something like this, and it just came together. So it was a lot of fun. But speaking of the conference, that's coming up June 21st and 22nd here in Alton, Illinois, at the Best Western Premier Hotel. We are 2/3 of the way sold out now, so we've still got a little over a month and a half to go by the time you hear this. Get your tickets. I'm telling you, we've got after-hour events. Some have already sold out. Some of them are close to being sold out. We're, like I said, 2/3 of the way to sold out. So you don't want to miss this event. It's a blast. I'm sure we'll be recording some stuff. I know that we'll have a table for the podcast there at the event.
Yep.
We'll be recording some stuff again this year, some interviews with some of the people, and it's going to be fun. So you'll get to hear some of it, but it's hearing about it on the podcast is definitely not the same as being there. So it's something that you don't want to miss if you're into this stuff. So just quickly, we had a few other events coming up. We added a tour, which I'm going to confess to you that we're recording this a little before it's going to happen. But on May 4th, we have a Ghost of the River Road tour. We rescheduled when we had some seats available for it. An Evening with the Dead on May 24th. I think I forgot to mention that in our last episode.
I think you did, yeah.
That is an evening, a dinner, and a presentation on American funeral and death customs. Everything from, you know, burials and mourning traditions to post-mortem photographs, all that kind of stuff. My friend April Slaughter and I did a book last year called Disconnected from Death, and it's kind of goes hand in hand with that book. On July 13th, Evening with the Black Dahlia, which is, I think that says it all in the title. And then we have an Evening with the Axeman on August the 10th, which is kind of about, you know, an illustrated version of the podcast.
Yeah,
there you go.
That's true.
All in one evening with visuals. So, and we're going to, you know, hit some people with axes to give you the idea of how how it all worked.
Right.
Blood spatter, things like
that. It's really it's an inclusive experience.
It is. We recommend raincoats, you know, that kind of thing, you know, so.
We'll have extras.
Just kidding.
Yeah, we can't joke that we're going to murder people.
Yeah, that's probably not a good idea. Yeah. So.
Awesome. Well, are you ready to dive
in?
Sure.
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right. So
this is what I like to call what did I say it before we started? I said a bridge episode or
a reactionary episode.
This is kind of what happened to give you an idea of how it affected these people's lives. That's kind of what this episode was about. It's not, I know, and I apologize, not a super long. It wasn't a super long episode, but this was all stuff that is integral to the story, so it needed to be told.
Yeah, so absolutely. So in Villisca, we have what you called the Summer of Fear in southwestern Iowa, which I think sounds like a great concert that I would want to go to.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. And featuring one of the bands, The Morbid Curious.
Yes. And we're actually going to touch on that later, but I like it. I love it. So
that I used it again.
Well, I mean, I love it, but yeah. I'm gonna mention that to you later. So. Obviously, people are scared, you know, from the things that have happened, but it wasn't just that. It was really weird.
It was a weird summer.
Yeah, weather and
stuff.
Yeah, it
was a weird summer.
Damaging winds, violent electrical storms, at least half a dozen farm buildings near Villisca, including two houses, several barns, were destroyed by wind or burned after being hit by lightning.
Struck by lightning. Those people must have felt like they were under attack.
Right.
That summer.
Right. Well, they angered some god. They had to sacrifice someone. I don't know. Because also farmers lost a bunch of their crops.
Yeah.
And a new house built by John Slack burned to the ground.
Yeah.
So sorry, John. That's unfortunate. A few days after Ida and Lena's funeral, Sarah Stillinger lost her unborn son.
Yeah, she had a miscarriage.
And before the year was over, the family home was also destroyed by fire. So yeah.
Bad luck you for have the Stillingers,
to, you too. You have to believe that you're being targeted.
Yeah,
at this
no kidding.
Point.
You feel like Job at this point. So
yeah, exactly. So, and I mean, I'm sure I would, I'm not a doctor, I would attribute, I mean, losing her unborn son, I would definitely attribute that to stress from everything
absolutely.
That's happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's terrible. So the people in Iowa, they were able to, I don't know if it's a police station or the government, how it works, but they offered a $500 reward.
Well, the governor put up a $500 reward, and people didn't think, I mean, while that was a lot of money in 1912, mm-hmm. people were upset because they felt like it wasn't enough. But
right.
by
was,
law, that's
he
all he could do.
Right. And yeah. so I did.
But
I did,
they were at work on other things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did the math on that, and I'm not even making any jokes this time. It was about $13,000 today. But again, he was limited, and that's all he could do for the reward. But there was stuff going on behind the scenes, basically bringing in special investigators
right.
to operate sort of in secrecy, letting people know who needed
right.
to know.
Right.
But other than that, they were just kind of hush about it. You mentioned it seemed like an inadequate reward for finding the killer of eight people. So the Villisca residents vowed to raise more money for a reward, and they did. The thousands of dollars were deposited in the First National Bank in Villisca, which was owned by Frank Jones.
Right, which is ironic considering that a lot of people were thinking that he had been the one who had something to do with the murders.
Right. Were there a lot of banks, though? I mean, did they really have options?
There were a couple of – I mean, you got to remember, this town was a lot bigger than it is now.
Right.
I mean, there were, you know, restaurants and stores and, you know, an opera house and, you know, all these – the banks and all this stuff. So there was a lot more going on there. So there were several banks in town. That just happened to be the most prominent bank.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he owned it. And which, like I said, ironic because a lot of people were accusing him of a lot of things he didn't do, you know.
Yep.
But there's where the reward money was sitting, drawing interest.
Right. And then so some of the stuff behind the scenes that we mentioned earlier, the Burns Detective Agency is brought in. They bring in C.W. Toby is working as secret as locals complain about the state not doing enough. But he's working in secret. But he's also working at the same time as another detective, O'Leary, who was brought in by Hank Horton.
Right. He called him right away. He was working for the county. So you had O'Leary working for the county and you had Toby working for the state, both of them on the same case, but working independently.
Right.
And that's not even including all of the other detectives because a lot of smaller – I mean, these were big agencies.
Mm-hmm.
Pinkerton – O'Leary worked for the Pinkertons.
Yep.
Toby worked for the Burns. But there were lots of little – detective agencies that were sending guys kind of like on spec.
Mm-hmm.
They'd send them down there, and if they solved it, then it would pay off for everybody. But on the other hand, if they didn't solve it, they were out their expenses, and that's about it.
Yeah.
But there were also a lot of people who were there, you know, thinking that they were going to solve it, you know, armchair detectives
yes.
who decided to come down and view the crime scene
Which
themselves.
Seems like so much fun, but I know it's not good.
No, it just seems like, I mean, it seems like utter chaos,
yes.
but it's interesting.
Yes.
It is interesting because the fact that you could, it's a different time.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting thing that you don't have to be licensed in any way. And anybody could carry a gun back then.
Yeah.
So you just show up somewhere and say you're a detective.
Start asking questions.
Yeah. And you start asking questions. And, you know, I guess probably a lot of these guys probably felt like, you know, hey, maybe I could solve this. And, you know, I'm sure, I'm absolutely positive there are still lots of people out there today
yes.
who are the same
and
do the same thing.
And just get in the way.
Right. And end up getting in the way. But this was this whole thing was such a cluster anyway that, you know, they're hanging around Villisca looking for a killer who was long gone.
Yeah.
But they didn't know that.
I mean,
you know, and that becomes a big part of our story. The things that were going on behind the scenes in Villisca are as compelling as some of the murders that were happening,
mm-hmm.
really.
And we'll get into some
stuff.
Of that, some of that drama.
Yeah.
But you think at this time, at least, Toby and O'Leary didn't have any contact at this time.
No, there's no record that they had any contact, even though they were reporting back to the same people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Toby was reporting to the governor, and I'm not sure who O'Leary was reporting to, but all of them were dealing through the county sheriff and Hank Horton.
Right.
So he knew them both. He was dealing with both of them, but he wasn't taking Toby as seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess just because he'd come in undercover and was working for the state, and Hank hadn't had any say in you know, his hiring or anything like that. So I don't think he took him as seriously as it turned out that they had a suspect in mind, which was ridiculous.
Yes.
But they had a suspect in mind they didn't even tell him about.
Right. And so Toby has to write basically daily like reports and send them off, and he has to send them to three different people. So this is just me again being ignorant of the time. Does that mean he has to type the same letter?
No,
three
they
times?
Had there were you used to be able to take like sheets that you put in between pages and make copies.
Oh, like a carbon copy?
Like
sort
a,
of
yeah,
thing?
Like a carbon copy.
Okay.
Yeah. It was the same thing. And so he could file, you know, he could type up three reports by using just two sheets of carbon paper.
Got it.
And a typewriter would, you know, those things had enough bang to them that it would go through.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And so we find out with this that agencies and people, they're not sharing any information with each other,
right,
which causes a lot of problems. In the future, if you think about 9/11, Oklahoma City.
Oh, no, it's a continuing problem. It's still a problem. You know, when I was working on the music book, and, you know, I was writing about the Manson murders, mm-hmm. and, you know, that went on for months and months, but the detectives didn't believe that the Tate murders were connected to the LaBianca murders. They thought that was two completely different things.
Yeah.
And that went on for months before they finally linked the two of them.
Because everybody
together.
Wants the credit and right. in this case, the reward.
Yeah. I mean, you know, sure, that was 50 years ago now, this summer, but this was, you know, a little over 100 years ago, and nothing had changed in that 50 years. And it's still a problem today.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And so you mentioned the suspect earlier. There was a guy named Otto. He was spotted by Mark Kearns, who's a night watchman. This guy, when confronted, runs. And it's a big damn deal.
Which is weird. Which, you know, I guess here's what's weird. I think that Mike Kearns was one of two night watchmen who worked for the city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was really just like a step down from Hank Horton, really.
So do they have weapons? Can they arrest people? How does this work?
Yeah, they could. But I mean, there was usually nobody to arrest. Uh-huh. It was usually taking somebody drunk and putting them in the.
But they could arrest
they
people.
Could. Okay. But so on the night of the murders, he said that he saw someone he didn't recognize in the town square that night and didn't confront him. Well,
why would you?
But in hindsight, they're looking back and they're saying, oh, man, this guy really screwed up, right. You know, but. You know, he didn't. He had no way of knowing that anything
bad
was
going to
happen. So now everybody they don't recognize, they're confronting, which considering how many people were coming to town.
That's a lot of people.
You know, plus, you know, they're on the railroad line. There's a station there. In those days, trains often stopped at every station. And people would get off the train, they'd smoke, they'd, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then the train would take off again. And this guy had stepped off a train. He was right at the station. And Kearns confronted him, you know, like who, and this is in July.
Yeah.
This is almost a month after the murder. So we don't know why he ran off. I mean, maybe startled him or maybe he'd done something that
did something else,
you know, did something else or whatever, but took off running and it became a huge deal. And it was, the whole thing was ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, to the point that they blew it up so much that he became a suspect in murders that had happened a month before. I just don't even understand what they were thinking.
Yeah.
I could never wrap my head around this, but you know, and then
you're looking for answers, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, they were just getting more and more desperate as time went on. And so, you know, they're trying to track this guy down and they finally find him in Chicago where he lives.
Yes.
And it turned out that he had been working in Missouri and was just passing through on his way to Chicago. And they found him, you know, this clever detection work that they used to find that he checked his bags. I mean, yeah, because he was just passing through town. Well, anyway, when he found out that they were trying to find this guy, you know, Toby sent a letter to the governor and blew up his importance. And he didn't even know what was going on, if it was me, I would have been glad I didn't know what was going on with that mess.
Yeah, keep me in the dark.
Then he sends a letter to the governor and says, oh, yeah, we've arrested the suspect, you know, trying to get ahead of, you know, didn't want anybody to scoop him, so to speak.
Yeah.
It's like bad newspaper stories when reporters jump the gun. It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, he sends him a letter and says, oh, yeah, we've arrested this guy. And no, you didn't.
Right.
And besides that, you might have picked him up, but this guy didn't have anything to do with anything.
Yep.
Yeah, it was really bad.
Yeah, and it might be a controversial opinion, but I totally understand the instinct to run from the police, even if you've done nothing wrong.
Right.
It's scary. It's intimidating.
And how do you even know this guy was a cop?
Well,
he's a glorified door rattler.
You're right.
I mean, he's a night watchman downtown. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think he's wearing a uniform. I think he's just, I mean, I've never seen a picture of Hank Horton, who was the constable. I've never seen a picture of him in a uniform.
Right.
It's always just him in a suit.
Right. Well, and it also sounds like they're just arresting people whimsically.
Yeah, you could back then.
Yeah, so you don't want to get caught up in that.
Yeah, you could get away with a lot of things. There were no Miranda warnings or anything. You could just take people down and beat the crap out of them as an interrogation in those days.
Right.
You know?
And who knows? It might have happened to him before. You know,
he's like,
not getting the shit beat out of me again.
Right.
So finally, we're getting to a part that I've really been wanting to talk about. In July, Reverend Kelly's back in town, and he's now referring to himself as a detective, claiming that he had trained as a criminologist while living in London.
I'm going to guess he read a Sherlock Holmes story somewhere. And
that's the same thing, right?
Yeah, he probably told one of the detectives that he lived at 221B Baker Street in London and, you know, trained there with his friend Dr. Watson. I mean, this guy's a complete nutcase.
Yes.
I mean,
and the detectives there took two different routes. Yeah. Toby wanted nothing to do with him.
Yeah.
O'Leary, however, he cultivated the relationship and he's like, yeah, what do you got?
Well, it makes you wonder if maybe he thought, you know, he met this guy and it's like, this dude is so weird. And he was there on the night of. Maybe if I glad hand this guy for a while, maybe it'll turn out he did something.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he suspected him. I can't imagine he took him seriously. Guy worked for the Pinkertons.
Right.
I can't imagine he took him seriously, you know, as a criminologist.
Yeah.
Because he's obviously crazy. But I just don't, I don't know why he would cultivate a relationship with him unless he suspected him of something.
Well, it kind of,
or maybe thought he saw something.
It was going to say it's foreshadowing for the future because he maybe knows, hey, this guy is crazy, but he might know something.
He might know something
that I can work with. But we'll get to that in the future. So, and we mentioned that this summer of fear, the nighttime was still bad in Villisca because the initial terror had
passed. You didn't mention about Reverend Kelly was the thing about, I thought for sure you'd comment about him at the hotel doing a reenactment of the murders.
Yeah, we talked about
it's
it
like
outside.
My favorite part.
Tell us about this
whole story.
This incident.
Yeah, it's just he would just, you know, we talked about it before, and I was reading about it, but he would talk about the murders to anybody
who
would listen, and then the night they had to call Mike Kearns to come down to the hotel because he was in the lobby with a captive audience of people there reenacting the murders and was getting so worked up they called the police. And I thought, this is why O'Leary must have cultivated a relationship with him, because he just thinks this guy's got to be connected to this somehow.
Right. Well, I think it's also the flip side. It's probably why Toby was like, I'm not touching that.
Yeah, absolutely. That, and I don't need to carry around a towel with me because every time he talks to me, he spits all over me.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. I think we all know people like this.
And
sir, this
close
is a,
talkers.
This is a McDonald's. Please. Yeah. Can you just give me your order? Like, I don't need to know about your conspiracies here. Yeah. So nighttime was still bad in Villisca. The initial terror had passed, but it was still common to find like 2 to 3 families just sleeping in one house because safety in numbers, people are terrified.
Right.
They'd get done with their chores at night and they'd say, all right, we're going to go shack up and, you know, get together. So this town is still just devastated by this and living in fear. I want to talk a little bit about the newspapers around this town or around this time because they sound great.
Well,
the quotes that you put in this
episode.
There
weren't a lot of libel laws back then either. So,
and they were, it was brutal. You know, it's like, it could be my family. It could be your family. Someone's going to be
next. That was a good one. And that was the sheriff though. That was Sheriff Jackson was quoted in the newspaper with this, you know, this whoever this is, he's looking for you, you know? And it's like, dude, you're like the sheriff.
Yeah.
Chill out.
Come on, man.
You know?
Well, I just want to say I'm glad that we've gotten away from the fear-mongering days of the press, you know, and they're not trying to scare us into anything and everything anymore. Okay, so there was another axe murder. Another axe murder occurred in Illinois in September, and even though it would turn out to have no connection to Villisca, it still sent shockwaves through the investigation, and it nearly ruined the relationship between Burns Detective Agency and the state of Iowa.
Right. Right.
Okay. So can we jump into Illinois now?
Yeah.
So we're going to go to a town called Payson, Illinois. Where is it?
It's just a little east of Quincy. It's close. It's like 12 miles from Quincy. It is a tiny, it's kind of like Villisca, much smaller now than it was in 1912. It's a much smaller town.
There
isn't a whole lot there, but this was a big deal when it happened. And, you know, the initial idea was here were people murdered in their beds, except in this case, the house had been set on fire. So it was somewhat different, but it was still close enough especially, you know, in the wake of the Colorado newspapers, you know, writing about, you know, the connections between mm-hmm. murders and that kind of thing. And so they're thinking it's got to be the same guy.
Right.
It's got to be the same guy.
At least they're finally putting pieces together, right, even if they're not exactly correct.
This is kind of what killed it, though.
Yeah.
And this is why it took so long for people to come back around to the idea that this was a serial killer. Because when this turned out to have nothing to do with Villisca or the other murders, they said, oh, well, you know, maybe there's no connection between any of them.
Right.
And then,
right,
then back we go to, you know,
right,
this was,
we're
this
back was, to square one.
Right. We're back to, this must be somebody local in Villisca again.
Right.
And this is what did it. This is what put us back to that.
Right.
That
so,
spot.
So it's Sunday, September 29th, 1912. Charles Fanschmidt, is that how you pronounce that? Okay.
Yeah.
Wife Matilda and their 15-year-old daughter Blanche, and then Emma Kim Pin, a teacher who was boarding with the family. Their bodies are all discovered on Sunday after a fire had spread through the house, and their phone lines had also been cut. It's three women who have been bludgeoned to death with an axe, and then Charles, his body had been dismembered with knives and a saw. So immediately I'm like, well, this is different.
Right.
You know, similar, but not
But they
the
were
same.
Grasping for anything.
And you know, why
and
wouldn't
it's not,
you?
It wasn't that far. I mean, it's some distance. It's several hundred miles, but it's not that far.
Right.
And who knows,
maybe he's revising his techniques or something again, or his methods or something, or circumstances change and he had to do something. So both Toby and O'Leary are sent to investigate, and this is when the men clash. And it causes situations that managed to help the serial killer, that managed to help this killer escape prosecution, is what you said in your monologue. So Ray Fanschmidt is the only surviving offspring, and he is immediately arrested. And then police find some bloody clothing. So where did they find these clothes exactly?
The whole thing was, you know, there were buggy tracks, but they may be his.
Right.
And the clothes might be
they
his.
Match the, well, the treads.
There was a guy who lived near this tent that Ray was living in at the time. He'd gone to work for a construction project for the railroad. And he was living in a tent, and there was a guy who lived somewhere nearby, and he had an outhouse on his property and was moving it,
okay,
as you often had to do, because after a while,
fills up.
Yeah. And so he was moving it, and when he moved it, he found a bundle of clothing that somebody had tossed down the, which gross.
Yeah.
But it
just
found
leave
a, some clothing that looked like it had blood on it. You can't test
How
it.
Could
I mean,
you,
yeah, it could be anything.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it goes right back to that, you know, the chicken blood, or, you know, you use,
right,
you know, work pants and you chopped a head off a chicken. Nobody knows. And so they didn't ask him. They asked his fiance, do these look like Ray's clothes? I guess they might be.
Yeah, maybe.
And that was enough. And he was a, you know, he was like a ne'er-do-well son,
yes,
who bummed money and, you know, spent, you know, was his account was always overdrawn,
yep,
and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, when his father and mother both died, you know, and with all of his sister dead too,
mm-hmm,
I mean, he was going to inherit a lot of money. And so there you go. And so that was enough. And they just immediately said, okay, that's it. You know, it's got to be him. Well,
right,
O'Leary shows up and looks into this and went, yeah, this doesn't have anything to do with Villisca.
Right. But Toby had a different point of view.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, so he sees things a little differently. And he ends up getting hired on as an expert witness to try to say it could have been this transient,
right,
butcher. We don't,
right,
know that it's this,
right,
this same guy. And that causes a lot of problems. So something that you mentioned that I didn't know about and I thought was interesting. So it's common practice in multiple murder cases to charge the defendant with only one death. That way, if exonerated, they could try him again and get around double jeopardy.
They still do that some.
Really?
It used to be a lot more common.
Mm-hmm.
It still happens today even. You'll hear about a case of, you know, a whole group of people being murdered, but they'll only put you on trial for one of them.
I didn't know that.
And then that way you've got a backup.
Yeah.
And they used to do that a lot. That's how so many of these trials just get done over and over and over again. And when you look back in history, but it's still a doable thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's still a possibility. You've always got a backup.
Yeah.
You know,
which I don't know how I feel about that. You know, I just, because I mean, the way the justice system works is you're defending someone, even if you think they're guilty. What you're trying to do is make the prosecution prove it, you know,
and
beyond a reasonable doubt sort of thing. And I don't know. I don't want somebody to get off and you know, for something that they did and have no chance to get any kind of retribution. But again, I don't want to lock up innocent people.
Well, but it also seems like that. It seems like you're not really that confident about your case.
Yeah.
You know what,
yeah,
I mean? If you're not that sure that you can get them on, you know, four murders.
Yeah.
Instead, you're trying them for just one of the murders. And that, but it was a fairly common technique. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it makes sense because of the way the laws work, but I could see a judge definitely being like, you don't seem like you got this on lock exactly. Right. So I don't know.
Things were different. I mean, look what they arrested him on.
Right.
I mean,
well, no wonder people run like from the police then.
Yeah, this was like the, you know, the epitome of circumstantial evidence. I mean, this was just so weak.
Yeah.
You know, the whole case was really weak. And I mean, that's not to say he didn't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, for all we know, he did. I mean, somebody did. It wasn't our Billy the Axe Man. But, I mean, somebody did it, and it certainly could have been him. But you certainly couldn't prove it with the evidence that they had against him.
You know,
as it turned out.
I would be pissed too at the fiance. It's like, when you say you're going to marry me, you take on the responsibility to cover. Nope, he was with me from 2 to 4 a.m.
Yeah, right.
He doesn't wear those clothes. You kidding me? Yeah, he never wears blue. Yeah,
thanks a lot.
Something like that. So eventually he's tried, but he's exonerated on all these different murders.
First they found him guilty, and that was purely on emotion.
So when they go back, is it an appeal then that they go back?
Yeah, they appealed, and his attorney said, you know, this shouldn't have been tried in Quincy, 12 mm-hmm. miles from where it happened.
Yeah.
Because everybody had already been turned against him.
Right.
And so, but then, you know, he eventually was cleared of everything and disappeared.
Collects his inheritance, pieces out.
Off. Yeah.
And you said the only connection between these murders and Villisca is that they were just both never solved.
Never solved. Yeah.
Yeah. So Billy Axeman had now taken on a role of a Midwest boogeyman lurking behind every murder where an axe was used, and even some where an axe wasn't used.
Yeah.
So Council Bluffs, Iowa in the summer of 1912, families found murdered. Early reports indicate incorrectly that it's Billy, but we know it's not because of a suicide note, and among other things.
Well, among other things. But, you know, a murder happened and it wasn't that far away, so they just automatically assumed it must be connected.
Right. So
same story all over again.
Families killed, their throats are slit, and then they're killed, hit with a hammer, and then the man who did it, the father in this group, he slits his own throat to kill himself?
Yeah.
That is so weird to me.
Yeah, actually, I've actually written about, and this is all older stuff, usually it's usually with straight razors, but I've written about quite a few people who've done
that. Your throat, not your wrist or something, huh?
Yeah.
That just, I mean, it's all fucked up, but it seems really weird. And so this just makes me think, you see, kids, monsters are real.
Yeah.
They just look like you and me.
Yeah.
Okay. It's just that taking yourself out that way, that's just, I can't imagine. But anyway, so they use an interesting tactic then to try and get the killer to come forward. And this makes a lot of sense for stuff you were telling me about in the first couple episodes. They claim to have a photo of the killer, and they say in Villisca, and they said that the reason they had it is because Lena had a picture of the person who killed her trapped in her retina, essentially, like the last thing you
believe it or not, this was a common belief.
Yeah, and then you mentioned that
a few years before that, people believed that that was a, you know, in the early days of forensics, I guess, you know, when fingerprints were thought to be a mythical kind of thing, that surely everyone's fingerprints aren't different, that kind of thing.
Right.
And there were a lot of people who honestly believed that a dying person, the last image they saw would be imprinted on the retina of their eye.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could remove that image somehow by taking a photograph of it, then you could find the face of the killer. I mean, this was actually a common thing.
So crazy.
And so somebody planted this story in the paper, even though no picture like that was taken. But because people were familiar with it, it was, they were hoping, I guess, the killer into turning himself in. And so they printed it in the paper that it had happened, and they were just waiting on the development of the photograph so that they could see who it was. And I think they wanted someone to panic, turn themselves in. And, obviously that didn't happen.
Yeah.
And
which I understand.
It wasn't real.
I understand the tactic for sure. It's interesting.
And it's not true. You can't actually do
it. It's interesting to me. Yeah. Because as we all know, the visual information you see, it is stored on the retina and not somewhere.
Right.
But it kind of makes me wonder about in the future, would you be able to, you know, light up the brain and grab some visual information of someone, you know, I don't know where stuff's stored. I don't know how that works.
Is there a movie like that? Or
it's like a Minority Report stuff
things. Something like that.
Which is very, it's kind of different. But I wonder, you know, could you tap in and see what people have seen and how biased would it be? You know, I don't know. It's very interesting. This was dumb, but I understand it for the time.
But that's how desperate people were getting.
And I mean, props to them for getting creative with it and trying something out.
I just don't think they knew what else to do.
Yeah. So they're at a loss, and the killer, he is on his way to Kansas.
Well, no, he was already gone. We're on our way to Kansas.
Because
we're going to go back to the last murder that happened before Villisca.
Got it. Okay, so I can't keep these timelines straight.
I
know. Troy.
Well, it's because I have alternate timelines running through the podcast.
It's so true. Okay, if you've ever seen the show Lost, we're doing like flash sideways, yeah, right. Flash forwards, flashbacks.
Exactly.
It's now time for our Ghostwriter segment. If you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. So we received an email from a man named Mark Voorhees, which I thought the last name was interesting. And he said, he asked us if we've ever heard of Black Eyed Kids or Black Eyed Children. Have you ever heard of this?
Yeah, I've heard of it. And it seems like something to be right up your alley.
Yes. So I'm going to give a little definition here. So basically, the Black Eyed Kids or Children are a folk phenomenon of people having strange encounters with kids whose eyes are entirely black, who insist upon entering their vehicle or home, and who seem to ooze an overwhelming sense of fear and panic. These are just kids to me.
Right.
Children, not just like just normal children. One of my good buddies, Jack, has sent me videos about this before, and he's like, "Hey, check this out! I know you hate kids. Look at this." And these stories, it's basically, you know, people will see a kid on the side of the road, or a lot of times they'll come up to their house and knock on the door and be like, "Hey, we need to come in, use the phone," and like something's just off about it. It's like the Resurrection Mary, but like evil sort of, and with children, you know. But I mean. Have you written about this or talked about it at all?
I mean, I've heard of it. It's I always just sort of put it in a category of, you know, shadow people and things like that.
Yeah.
It's not anything that I've really ever encountered. You'll hear people talk about it sometimes, but I've never actually spoken to anyone firsthand who's mm-hmm. ever encountered a black-eyed children.
Do you think is this an internet, like Reddit phenomenon sort of thing?
I don't think so.
Is it older than that?
Yeah, I think it's older than that. Just because people have been talking about it for so long, I won't say it doesn't exist. I mean, it's, you know, I don't think we're talking about the realm of Slender Man here.
Right.
I mean, I think there's probably something to it. It's just not anything I've really had any kind of experience with.
Right.
Or even, you know, secondhand experience with. So, no, it's not.
Well, if you've had any experience with black-eyed kids, you, not your buddy's uncle's, you know, dog.
Your cousin's stepbrother.
Write in, tell me about it. I need more reasons to be terrified. moving on, the next email we got was from Leslie, and she said, "Hey, you know what? I think you should call your listeners the Morbidly Curious." And I was like, you know, that's kind of like, I like it. It adds up. I think people who listen to this podcast probably are morbidly curious.
Probably.
That might really hinder Troy's plans for calling his band that.
Yeah, but, right.
But I think that will be okay. Last but not least, we have a couple new patrons that I wanted to give shout-outs to. So thank you for supporting our show, Elizabeth, Teresa, Ken, and Christopher. And if you would like to check out our Patreon and see what kind of different rewards and fun stuff we have and access to bonus episodes and T-shirts and things like that, you can do so at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings.
Okay, well, I think we'll wrap this up. And with that note, I'd like to thank everybody again for listening and for your emails and your comments and your reviews and that kind of thing. So please, you know, leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to the show. And we'll, who knows, we may read it on the air, or we may just show it to each other and go, "Oh, well, great, cringeworthy," you know, whatever. Yeah. So anyway, thanks everybody for listening, and we will see you again next time.
This episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written by Troy Taylor. It is produced and edited painstakingly by me, Cody Beck. In each episode, we try to combine history, folklore, legend, imagination, and the truth to reveal more about America's most haunted places, strange tales, and unexplained events, like this podcast. American Hauntings is a bi-weekly podcast. Check out our new episodes on your morning commute every other Tuesday to hear our latest episode and take a brand new look at history and hauntings. You can learn more about our podcast and find new episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, CastBox, Spotify, or your other favorite podcast apps by searching for American Hauntings, or you can go to AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, where we also have links to Troy's books, information about upcoming tours, events, and haunted happenings. Remember, if you love the show, American Hauntings is more than just this podcast. It's books, tours, events, ghost hunts, and the Haunted America Conference, all of which you can find at our website at AmericanHauntings.net. And if you're one of those people who wish we had a new show every week...
Good God, you talk about me reading too fast.
Well, you can have that. You have the chance to support the podcast by checking out our Patreon page.
At least you're putting some supporter, emphasis in it.
You can get bonus episodes of the show, T-shirts, great stuff in the mail, and more. We're extremely excited about producing more shows with better equipment, and with your help, we can dedicate more time and resources to making that happen. Take a minute and check it out. We think you'll like what you find at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. You can also find your hosts on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And if you have comments, suggestions, reviews, or jokes, be sure to pass them along. Until next time, goodbye, so long, see you later.
All right. Cool.
I'm just going to leave it in with the mistakes.
Oh, yeah, why not?
It's
why not?
Fun. It is just...